Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
For Ireland and globally, and I say this with a very heavy heart, to have a 50% chance of 1.5 degrees requires 20 to 30% cuts in CO2 from now. Well, those were the words of a leading climate scientist on the emission targets that we need to reach globally to halt the impact of climate change. But will our efforts be in vain? What can we do to slow it down? Joining me to discuss this is that expert, Professor Kevin Anderson, who is an expert in energy and climate change at the University's of Manchester and Uppsala. Kevin, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, it's nice to be with you.
Thank you for being with us this morning. Would you lay out for us in clear terms what these mind-blowing cuts you talk about look like in practice?
Well, if we were to deliver on that sort of level, then we'd be fundamental shifts to so many facets of our society, our transport networks. We wouldn't be able to have private cars the way we have them today. We wouldn't be able to have larger houses, those of us that live in those. Lots of our industry would have to change fundamentally. So almost every single facet of society would have to change. That is to deliver on the 1.5 degree C warming commitment that we had in the Paris Agreement, which is the tighter commitment we had. Even the weaker commitment, the 2 degree C commitment, would require really fundamental changes in our society. But let's just also be clear that most emissions come from relatively small groups of us in our society. So whilst you look at it on average, you might say that sounds terrible and we'll all have to change our lifestyles. Actually, what it really means is for those of us that are the relatively wealthy in our society, who almost always have the higher impacts, it is for us there will be fundamental changes to virtually every aspect of our lives. For the majority of people, it would be big structural changes in the quality of their houses, in the quality of public transport, in the types of jobs that they do. So I think we have to sort of break this down within the country and think that fairness plays out very differently because the emissions come from particular groups of people, usually, I say, wealthier people in our society.
So what are they doing wrong?
Well, just look at the sort of lives that we typically lead. And I'm not picking on anyone in particular here, but we often live in bigger houses. We have larger cars that are often more fuel efficient. We drive further. We fly more. We fly business class. We have double door refrigerators. Some of us have second homes. So at every single level of life, we're consuming far more than the average are in our society. And we are the ones that are driving that agenda. So airport expansion is driven primarily by the frequent flyers, who are typically the wealthier people in our society. And that's true across the board. Almost every area of society where we're seeing ongoing growth, it has been dominated by the relatively wealthy in our society. This isn't just true in Ireland. This is true in every industrialised country.
But for people who don't have as much in terms of wealth, their lives would be changed for the better by the structural changes that you told us about. Better housing,
yes.
Better
yeah.
Transport.
Yeah, and better jobs. I mean, these are high-quality jobs, apprentice jobs, long-term jobs. So, I mean, this is why I think it's really important to bear in mind, if we are serious about climate change, for a large swathe of our societies in industrial communities, actually, they will be better off from this. Better air quality, better quality homes. They can afford to heat their homes. They will not require as much heat in their homes. So that means there'll be less damp, less bronchial conditions for their children, so better educational attainment. Across the board, it is better for the majority of people. But to pay for that means moving the resources that currently, to be blunt about it, provide the sort of luxuries for people like me and the wealthier in our society, move them from us to actually making the betterment of society as a whole, to decarbonise our infrastructure.
Earlier in the programme, we were speaking to someone who had been to Kenya to one of these second-hand clothing markets where she saw 40 acres of a dump with 900 million tonnes of second-hand clothes coming from Europe. And you just hear something like that and you go, how do we get out of this? How do we stop this?
yes, I mean, the thing to remember here is that these are all global problems. We are in a globalized world now. So when we just throw something out, it plays out elsewhere in the world. In this case, I mean, I wasn't listening to that article, but this case, secondhand clothes being dumped in Kenya.
Yeah.
And it affects their local markets. It affects their local employment as well. So we have to think about these things in a global level. But I think fairness is a really key issue here. Fairness within our societies and fairness across the globe as well. And if we are prepared to unpick that, you get quite different results. And things that at a global level or at a national level might look less attractive. When you start to look at individually where this happens or in the sectors in our society, I think you can see that you can paint a much more positive narrative, a more positive story about doing something worthwhile mm-hmm. for the majority of us. And that is the key message to get across here. We're not all in this together. Impacts, climate impacts are playing out mostly on, at the moment still, on poorer communities, often a long way from the rich countries that are emitting, often communities that are typically have people of colour in them as well. The impacts are playing out there, but they've been caused by the wealthy people in the global north. And we think we can insulate ourselves from them, from the impacts. But even if you look at somewhere like Los Angeles, a very wealthy part of the world, we saw recently where climate change exacerbated the fires that were there that was devastating to a lot of the communities. So those impacts are going to play out in the global north as well.
Yeah, we shouldn't be secure, in other words, in our selfishness here.
No, certainly not. I mean, the direct impacts of climate change will increasingly play out in the global north, but they're hitting already very hard many other communities in the global south. But remember, again, because we're in a globalized world, if the global south has problems with impacts, say more droughts or more floods, that will affect their food production. And we're part of a globalized food network. So I don't know about this for Ireland, but the UK imports somewhere between 50 and 60% of its food. So if the price of food goes up for imports, then people in our societies, and again, it will be the poorer and the medium income people that will struggle to be able to buy good quality food. Mm-hmm. So even when these things happen elsewhere, the impacts, they will play out in the globalized market. They'll play out in terms of migration. They'll play out in terms of military tension and all those other things that are part of this globalized community we're in.
And Kevin, we have set our carbon budgets to reach net zero emissions by 2050, which is not all that far away, 25 years. How effective has that target setting exercise been?
To be brutally honest, it has failed. Not just in Ireland. I mean, Ireland has not been particularly good here. Ireland's emissions today are slightly higher than they were in 1990. So Ireland's demonstrated that over a third of a century of failure on climate change, its leadership has failed. Mm-hmm. But that is true for many other countries as well. A few have come down a little bit. The UK's come down a little bit, but still not much. So, yes, that target structure, and I prefer to see it as commitments and obligations. I think the language of targets is too easy to miss.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we need to think about obligations. If we are, you know, I'm obliged to look after my children. I don't have a target to look after my children. So we should see these are things we have committed to and therefore we must deliver on. But so far, it has fundamentally failed.
Well, you know, countries that have prioritised green energy, electric cars, carbon taxes, they have seen that voters in those democracies have punished them at the polls. Like, it is a real challenge for governments, for politicians to get the public on board, right? And also sectors like transport, like agriculture.
It is very difficult to get them on board. But I don't think that's because of the actual the policies or the technologies themselves. I think it's because the stories of these have been put across are incorrect. And I think being put across, because who owns the media? Who are the ones that shout the loudest? These are the wealthy high emitters in our society. The last thing that they want to see is an agenda that is going to make it more challenging for them. And so they have deliberately coloured and twisted the story, as indeed have the fossil fuel companies for decades on this. So if you think about when Putin invaded Ukraine, we saw a massive energy crisis across Europe. And I know it from the UK perspective better than Ireland, but I'm sure it's the same in Ireland, that many people could really struggle to afford to heat their homes,
yes,
to buy the fuel for
I
their
mean,
cars.
We had to have government intervention, as you did there too.
As we did here. Now, but why was that? Was that because we had too much renewable energy? Or was it because we were locked into a fossil fuel industry?
Yes.
No, it's because we hadn't got enough renewable energy. If we had made the move across 30 years ago when our leaders promised to do that, then we would have not have been in the same position when Putin invaded Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So I would turn this completely on its head, that actually when we start to have more renewable and low-carb energy, and we're much more efficient in its use, and when its use is fair in our society, we are much more resilient to the global changes in the energy market.
But, you know, you're saying this in the context of Donald Trump saying, drill, baby, drill, and, you know, pulling out of the Paris Agreement. It's a difficult argument to make in the face of what's happening across the Atlantic.
It is in some respects, but firstly, I mean, some American cities and some American states will still be locking themselves into trying to do something about climate change. I mean, they're not doing anywhere enough anyway, but they'll still be much more aligned with the weaker interpretation of Paris. So although Trump may be pulling out, other states and cities may not. And so I think we have to think of a more positive sort of symbol like that. But also I would say that Trump, to some extent, I mean, I'm reluctant to say this, but there's a sort of honesty there. He says, oh, you know, to damn with Paris. A lot of other leaders are saying, oh, no, we're doing everything we can. I mean, Michael Martin has said, Ireland is prepared to step up to do what it needs to do for 1.5 degrees centigrade. That simply isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
So you could argue on this, at least Trump's being honest about his view towards Paris.
Yeah, but does it give license to other leaders to pull back, you see?
There is a risk of that, but this is why I think this is why it's really important for the expert community to step up and for the journalists on this to actually paint the more constructive, positive narrative. You know, why were we in such a problem when Putin invaded? It wasn't because we had too much fossil fuels. It wasn't because we were locked into. It wasn't because we had too many renewables. It's because we were locked into the 20th century view of energy, which was basically just fossil fuels. So I think we have to create this more positive narrative. So Trump may well say, "Drill, baby, you know, drill in the state." But he's only there for 4 years. Climate change will continue well after Trump has gone. And so those leaders of the world who want to actually are genuinely concerned about people elsewhere in the world and their own communities, particularly their own children, then I think that those ones, if they have that sort of integrity, then it's very clear what the agenda needs to look like on climate change. So Trump will be gone in 4 years. Let's also bear in mind that America is, and I don't know why we're so obsessed with other states, it's 4% of global population. I think it's about 13% of global GDP, global economy. So that means like 87% of global economy is not the US. Why are we so obsessed by it?
Yeah, you see, I suppose when we're having this conversation on this programme, we will be faced with the argument all of the time from different sectors. Well, it will change our practices here. It'll cost us a fortune. We'll all lose money. While in South America, they're doing X, Y and Z. Or in China, they're burning fossil fuels to beat the band. I mean, are we stuck with this very big collective action problem here where people won't buy into it unless everybody is doing it?
Yeah, well, there is something. I think there is something in that. But it also, this is where the importance of leadership plays out. So you look at somewhere like Colombia, not the richest country in the world, but it's just said it's going to keep its fossil fuels in the ground. That would be much easier if the UK and Norway said, we're going to do it as well. Then you start to create a bit of momentum. We say, oh, China's terrible. It burns lots of coal. You know, what's it burning the coal for? To make my computer, to make the phone that I'm calling you. So
yes,
we buy the goods from China. But China are also putting up more wind turbines and more solar panels than virtually the rest of the world put together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's look at the positive stories that are coming out of some of these countries as well as focusing on the negative. But absolutely, this is a collective action problem, and what it requires is leadership and integrity. And if we appoint our leaders and then they vote or then they say they're going to commit the Paris Agreement, or like Michael Martin said that we're going to make our island will play its part on 1.5 degrees centigrade, it is my job as an expert, and I think it's the job of the journalist, to hold them to account. Do we assume they are lying when they say these things, or do we assume they're being honest? And if they're being honest, then we have to hold them to account at every turn. So leadership is key here. But leadership, of course, requires the rest of society, particularly in the democracy, to play its role in driving our leaders in the right direction.
Kevin, great to talk to you, and hopefully we'll get to chat again. That's Professor Kevin Anderson there, who is Professor of Energy and Climate Change.